Hey Rich, thanks so much for being a part of this podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. Look forward to chatting.
I want to ask you a couple of off-the-cuff questions. What is the biggest challenge in your current job?
Well, that's a big one. I mean, I think that there's a number of challenges, right, that we face, that AT&T faces, that we face kind of as in the industry is government relations or external affairs, legislative affairs, whatever term you want to call it. But I think it's really about finding the right way to communicate and to educate lawmakers or policymakers or stakeholders on what are the most important needs, what are the biggest challenges, and doing it in a meaningful and authentic way. Right now, you know, I think there's just, you know, folks see it on the news, they see it in the, they read it in the paper, they read it, you know, online. There's just so much noise out there that I think as an elected official, it's a challenge, right, to discern what is honesty, what is being, you know, upfront, what is real, what is, you know, accurate information versus, you know, what is just noise and what is not. And you know, in the government relations world, it's really trying to find a way to break through, you know, some of those barriers and tell an authentic story and tell it in a way that is meaningful and can you know, have an impact and reach legislators. Right now it's tough. I mean, that's just how there's a lot of skepticism on you know, so much information that's out there. That's what I think a lot of just, you know, kind of holistically we're challenged with is how do you tell a story that doesn't get bogged down or lost in so much noise that's out there today. So certainly one that I think, you know, the industry kind of tries to find different ways and approaches to do it. But like anything, it's, you got to have those relationships. You got to have that, the meetings, you got to be, you know, in person and in front of folks to look them in the eye and have that trust and have that relationship with them. That's the way to really kind of break through it. How you do it, right? Whether it's some, you know, digital component or, you know, the old fashioned in person. I think, you know, there's different ways to do it, but I think that you got to have those relationships and have built that trust with whomever the stakeholder may be that you're talking to.
And how would you define a lobbyist in one word?
One word? Storyteller.
Nice. If you had the opportunity to change one rule in the state government process, what would that be?
I don't know. It's a tough one. I think that, you know, that's a good question. I really don't know what the one rule I would change. I think that, you know, what happens right now is, that's a good question. Can we come back to that one? That's a good question. I really don't know. Honestly, I mean, I think that right now, you know, you look at it from, there's a standpoint of the rule in terms of how you or what your requirements to engage with the legislature, right? With reporting, you know, expenditures and what are permissible expenses and what aren't. That's one side of it. Then there's kind of the business, you know, side of it from you know, my role, which is, you know, certainly, you know, impactful. I think, you know, if anything, we just need to, you got to ensure that there's transparency in the system, right? You got to ensure that folks know what's going on. I think that's what often is plighted against, you know, lobbyists or kind of the industry at whole, is that folks think that there's a whole lot of, you know, lying or manipulation or backroom deals and all those kind of terms that we've heard. But the truth is, you know, a vast majority of this stuff is done out in the open, and it's just making sure that the public sees that and knows that and feels comfortable with the decisions and how lawmakers get to those decisions. And so I would say, as opposed to changing a rule, I think it's just, we just gotta make sure that the rules are set so that there's always transparency in the system, that there's always accountability in the system, and that folks don't feel like somebody's getting some special agreement or arrangement when things kind of, you know, as things develop. So you got to be clear and you got to be upfront and you got to be able to show folks what's going on. So they can get past those, as many folks have heard, right? The cigars and backroom deals. And I'll be honest, I've rarely ever had a cigar to begin with in my life, let alone in a back room, and have made zero deals in said back room. So I, you know, don't know where that came from, but it's certainly one of the things that makes me chuckle when you think about it. It's just that doesn't actually happen, but I think that it's really a metaphor for how folks kind of want to see, make sure that there's stuff is done out in the open and that it's done fairly and transparently. I think that's one thing we should have to maintain and ensure that we continue to do that.
Nice. What would you be if you weren't a lobbyist?
Honestly, I would probably be, I think if I wasn't a lobbyist, I would go and just, I'd be a farmer. I know nothing about farming and I know nothing about cattle or crops or any of that stuff, but I'd figure it out. If I could do anything, had all the money in the world to go do it, that's what I'd do. I'd go and have a bunch of land and just kind of, do my thing out there. But I don't foresee that ever happening, but that's, if I could, sure, yeah, that'd be fun.
Nice. You're the second person this week who said they would like to go back to farming on the podcast. So it's pretty cool.
I'm not going back to it. I've never been a farmer, right? So that's my problem is it's like, just walking blindly into this thing. I don't know the first thing about it, but I like to pretend that I do. So yeah, maybe. So certainly something with my hands, something outdoors.
What was the most momentous thing in your career?
I will say this, it's actually kind of not momentous as opposed to kind of life lessons, right? Is I remember, growing up as a kid, right, being able to, have decent success in school and sports and the like. And in one of my very first jobs out of college, I worked for a state house campaign in Tennessee. And I put everything I had into it. I put all my blood, sweat, tears, all into this thing. I worked for hours and hours and hours. And I was the way this campaign was set up, I was really the only paid staff person, there. I was managing volunteers. I didn't really know anybody in this community, but I mean, I was out there just grinding for at least six plus months and, felt confident as we went in the election and the guy lost. And I distinctly remember sitting in my car and I'll say this, I remember sitting in my car. I was down at the polling place and I knew he'd lost, got my car by myself. And I just cried. I was just so upset, right, with what had happened. I had failed. I had, it just totally, set me back. And I just couldn't believe that all this work for nothing effectively. Right. But as I kind of moved on past that, you look back on it and it's like, that failure taught me so many lessons, right? If I had won that thing, all the things that I thought I did right, I wouldn't have never, I would have assumed that they were right. I would have assumed that this approach was the right way or this lesson that I did, it was right. I don't think I would have learned as much had I not. So I think that failure, frankly, honestly gave me some things to look back on and say, here's how you can do it differently. Here's how you could have improved. Should have done it this way or that way. And in hindsight, it's always 20/20, but I just don't think that those lessons would have been learned had the candidate won. I really don't think. I think I would have just thought, I did it great. Let's move on. What's the next thing? But that failure was one of the first big times I've ever really had kind of upset that loss, frankly, and until that point in my life. And I think it was a great learning experience, honestly.
And could you share what was the most important lesson you learned from that failure?
I think it was more, many of them were more tactical. It was more, I think at least in campaigns, a lot of people think, yard signs are it, right? You got to have signs up. And while I don't disagree, you got to really have, it's more about the holistic name ID, especially in races where you don't know the candidate. The candidate is new to the scene. You got to have one, the right candidate, and two, that the name ID. But it's not just built on signs and signs alone. We had a number of signs out, right, and yard signs and all the like, and those help. But you got to find multiple avenues, right, to tell your story, multiple ways to reiterate and reinforce your story, because on campaigns, I think people that are, you're working on them, you think the whole world is paying attention to exactly everything that you're saying, that every up and down, right, is everybody feels it too. And the reality is no, they don't, right? Most folks are not paying attention to your campaign. They're not paying attention to the everyday ups and downs of what happens. Most folks, frankly, are going about, they're going to work, they're going home, they're feeding the kids, they're going to bed, right? They might catch this, that, or the other every now and then, but they don't feel the ups and downs like you do. And so they don't hear the same message, right, that you do. You think you've heard the message 1,000 times, so everyone must have heard it, right? Like, how could they not vote for this candidate? Listen to what they're saying, right? Well, the reality is that most people aren't listening to what they're saying, and you just have to find different ways to tell that story, whether it's online, whether it's in person, whether it's signs, whether it's knocking on doors, whether it's social media, you name it, right? You just got to find ways to continually repeat it, and it's just as soon as you think that it's like, you're going to, you know, your ears are going to explode if you hear the speech or hear the message one more time, you got to keep going because others simply just, they haven't.
What is the best compliment you have ever received?
I think the folks have said that, you know, very adaptable, can kind of figure out what's, you know, figure out the problem solving and the challenges. So I think that, you know, folks say I'm creative or, you know, very, flexible. I'm always shocked, right? Cause I think in my head I'm not, but, you know, it is a skill I think that is critical, right? For this industry is to be able to solve problems, to be able to adapt to your environment. You know, in the job I've got now and many passion, right? You can go and meet with one group of one audience, right? Whether it's policymakers or community, whatever it may be, that have one, you know, set of facts, one view, one mindset, one, you know, political slant. And in that afternoon, you're talking to a totally separate group. You got to be able to wear both hats and have that flexibility and that adaptability to know your audience. And so, you know, I think when I've heard that, it's always kind and appreciated. You know, I think for me, I just try to just get up and do my job each day and go home, get two kids and wife and yard to cut and all those kind of things. And so there's also just the realities of it. And but I do appreciate it and appreciate what folks say those things. But you know, it's a tough job, right? It's a stressful and taxing job, but I think that it's a job that you know, when you look back on it, especially at AT&T, been able to do a lot of really, really impactful things in the community and across the state that wouldn't have otherwise, right? So you just got to take the good with the bad. And when folks say you're flexible, you're adaptable, you're a good problem solver, I enjoy that. I appreciate that. That's always something I value.
Nice. And did anything surprise you when you got into government relations about the job?
I think, you know, the way at least my mind works is very linear, logical, right? I don't think that I realize how oftentimes in politics, I realize it pretty quickly, right? But how oftentimes in politics, logic and reason are often not the decision-making factor, right? You look at it from a business perspective, hey, I need to go and invest X dollars into this market, and it's going to produce this return. Makes sense, right? You go forward and do it. That's not always the same rational thought, right, that occurs in politics. It's you kind of got to realize all the variables and all the other factors that are at play. It's you know, this bill is being held up because the sponsor has some other bill that's out there that somebody else doesn't like, and da 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 da. So you kind of get all these other, you know, third party kind of variables, if you will, come into play. And so a lot of times, unfortunately, you know, the most rational thinking thought, right, that we're all on board with, everybody kind of agrees with, isn't what sees the light of day. And you know, the frequency with which that occurs can sometimes, you know, was eye-opening, but that just goes back to my, you know, original point. You just got to continue to stay on message, continue to tell that story, continue to you know, tell that narrative as to why whatever you're advocating for or against is the right thing. Because as soon as you think you got it going, it's going to happen, right? The election is going to occur, or the vote's going to occur, or whatever it may be. It doesn't, right? So there's something that comes up, and you just got to be able to adapt, right, to whatever that scenario that comes out for you.
I'm going to switch gears here. Yeah. If you had an opportunity to have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who would those be?
I think I would go with the past three presidents, all three of them.
Nice.
Biden, Trump, Obama. Let's all have dinner together. Let's see how that shakes out. I think that folks in those roles is I'd love to just kind of get a sense of how they think and what they think. And and you can also any you know, I find you know, CEOs of large, you know, companies, I'm always shocked at, like, how do these folks, you know, like, go to you know, maybe like on Saturday, are they outside cutting the grass or like, what are they doing? You know, I mean, like, those are the things I've always been curious to kind of know, like, you know, the these jobs that are just so demanding and just require so much time and energy. Kind of, how do they look at the world from a standpoint of, you know, do you plan your family vacation, or does someone, like, how does that, how did all these things kind of occur? I don't know. It just seems it's interesting. So, you know, kind of anybody in that realm, but I think that it would be interesting to the last presidents to sit down and see what they have to say. You might come out with a bit more gray hair than I've already got right now after that dinner, but it would certainly be interesting, that's to say the least.
Well, that's a very interesting insight you have. I mean, I'm curious to now I'm curious to know what are they doing on Saturdays. Actually, that's very true.
Yeah.
If you had a time capsule to go back in time to any era, which era would you pick?
I have to go back in time. Can't go forward in time, right? Let's see. I think that somewhere in 1800s, 1830s, right? And I say that because I don't know if folks here are a fan of the show Yellowstone, the prequel, right? The 1883 when they're on the Oregon Trail. When you think about, the guts that it took for someone to say, hey, what my scenario right here is so bad, I'm gonna go put all my family in a wagon, we're gonna go trek across the country for the opportunity for a better life, for better land, for better opportunity. Man, it just took a lot of guts, right? And I'd just be curious. I'd want to see it. I'd want to be kind of a part of it. And certainly there's some hard times and hardships that occur, but I mean, I look at it today is if you did that today, it's like saying, hey, you've got a spaceship, you can go to Mars, you can take all the property, you can have everything you want, but by the way, you got to get there on your own, and you got to fly the ship, and no one's here to help you. Like, I mean, would you do it? And it's crazy when you think about the risk and the guts it took to do that. So I'd enjoy seeing that in person.
Nice. Let's go back a little bit into your past. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up, and did you have any interest in policy or politics back then?
Yeah, so I grew up here in Metro Atlanta, South Forsyth High School, actually, for those from Metro Atlanta. And then I went to University of Tennessee. Growing up, politics and stuff were always kind of a topic point in our household, at least, my dad. It was something that I could relate to him with as he'd watch the news and provide, standard dad commentary on the news in the world, right? But it was a way to kind of interact with him. And then when I went to school, it was, I actually wanted to be an attorney had toward doing a pre-law degree, but I thought I was talked out of not doing this. You do a political science degree, it gives you more options. Well, by the time I was a junior or senior in college, I think I was tired of being poor, right? Which was like, I'm not going to law school. I can't keep this rate up, right? Where it's, you got 15 bucks in your checking account overnight. And I just says, we're gonna get a job. So that's kind of from there. I've been doing campaigns and political stuff really out of college. Worked for the Technology Association of Georgia, doing government and public affairs for them nearly a decade plus ago. I've been at AT&T. In fact, it'll be in July 22nd. I've been at AT&T for 10 years, and so. I've had a career so far in kind of the public facing space, the government relations space since the beginning. It's certainly been one that I've enjoyed and, certainly one that is one where, hey, there are no 2 days that are the same, right? There's going to be things that are to come up and you got your to-do list. And rarely do I ever actually get through the to-do list that I start with at the beginning of the day because something else kind of comes up, in between, but, it's been fun. So, but I've been really kind of around the politics, the campaigns, and like I said, now at AT&T for 10 years. I started at AT&T as an external affairs manager, where I had kind of a region of counties in actually South Metro Atlanta, and then in roughly I think it was 2015-ish, became a director and kind of managed that team of external affairs managers. And then when it was, I want to say it was, trying to think now, 2019, got promoted to assistant vice president, and have kind of picked up the regulatory stuff and now the legislative stuff as well. So it's been a good career at AT&T thus far, and it's been a great company to work for. A lot of opportunities and a lot of things that, like I said, I wouldn't have gotten to do, elsewhere. So it's a great place to be able to impact the community, impact the place I grew up, right, where my home is here, as well as do something I'm passionate about with respect to, politics and policy and community engagement.
And which college did you go to? Tennessee?
I did. I went to the University of Tennessee, so I catch a lot of grief being back here, in Georgia, having not gone to UGA or a state school. But I grew up in Georgia, went there, came back effectively. So, but it's I always get can't you know, tell people you're in Tennessee, and at least in Georgia, you're kind of get
Oh, I
frowned
see.
upon of lately. But I've gotten used to the ridicule and jokes. But no, it's good.
Nice. So after college, what was your first job?
That's the first jobs I worked. I actually worked for the Tennessee Republican Party for, I guess it was, I don't know, however many, a year or 8 months, something like that. It's funny, you look back, I'll tell you, I made $24,000 a year, right? Didn't even work there a whole year. It was $2,000 a month. And at the time, I was like, hey, that's better. I'm gonna have more than $15 a month in my checking account, right, each week. So I was happy to take it. But and that's what I would tell, folks that are young, right? Is, take that opportunity. Is $24,000 a year, especially nowadays, a livable wage? No, I mean, that'd be tough to get by on. But at the time, I was a single guy, had an apartment, and that was about it. That was my really only expense, I think, at the outside of utilities. And so, and I worked all the time, right? So if you're coming out of college or about to enter the workforce, take those opportunities that come. That maybe they don't pay as great, maybe they're not the best, but they're an excellent learning opportunity. It's a great place to kind of get your feet wet, and honestly, it's more than anything else, is a great opportunity to build relationships. So with that role, right, I helped state house campaigns, and it was and the like. And so you're able to kind of engage with different folks and meet folks, whether it's in business or in politics for that matter. But you kind of got to take it if you want to do it. Those first jobs are tough. And I worked for Congressman Tom Price here in Georgia in his district office for a number of years, and it is it's a job that, I mean, again, you don't get paid a ton of money, but man, you learn so much, and so you kind of got to take the realize you're not going to get a huge salary maybe on day one, but you got to have those experience and kind of do that grind. When I look back, I think, if there were maybe one thing I would have done differently, I would have gone to DC. I think that would have been certainly cool to have gone up there and worked in a congressional office as opposed to here in the district. But the truth is, I've always been a hometown kind of guy and love Georgia and enjoyed working here and families here and the like. And so you got to do what's right for you, what's right for your family, but be willing to take that risk and maybe take a job that's I didn't get to pay what you might have hoped it would pay, but you do that for 6 months to a couple of years, however long it is, and the doors open up pretty quickly if you do it and do your job and do it well.
And is that something you still think of doing sometime in the future, like going to
No,
DC
not now.
today?
That time has passed, right? I got an 8-year-old and about to be 10-year-old, and those it's that ship has sailed. But I mean, it is but if I were 22, 23, 24 again, single, or even if I was, we didn't have kids, right? I think if then yeah. But I think that that being said, there's a lot of these jobs, right? A lot of these government affairs jobs, they do end up in DC one way or another, whether that is the first job or even kind of the most senior position job, they tend to land in DC. And certainly something that if you're entering this field, you got to think about, right? Is that something you'd ever want to do? But to each their own. I think there's great opportunities up there, but I've enjoyed and continue to enjoy living right here.
Nice. And is that something you would advise, like someone who wants to get into government relations? Do you think they should first go to DC, get that exposure, and then come back into state?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that it's once you get to DC, I think a lot of people get up there and they stay there. I don't know a ton of folks that go up to DC and frankly come back. I mean, it does happen, but that's definitely more the exception than the rule. I would tell folks that are at college, make sure if you're gonna do it, start with trying to intern at your congressional office, your local congressional office while you're junior or senior. I actually interned for John Linder years ago for a summer. And then in college, I worked for the Knox County Mayor's office. And I would say that those internships initially, right, really open up those doors. Because when you graduate, right, you're one of many people that all want to go to DC or go work in these offices. Start out as early as you can and get an internship, get a co-op, get whatever it may be. I was able to get college credit, I think, if I recall correctly, for working in the Knox County Mayor's office. So I only had two or three classes, and the rest of the day I went to go work there. And so, but having that you know, federal government and at the time local government experience, I think kind of, you know, diversified me. And then I went to, like I said, the Tennessee Republican Party. So you kind of had that state, local, and federal, all those boxes checked, and you really want to kind of spread out where you've worked with respect to government relations, because that's what companies hire. At the end of the day, they hire people that have worked in Congress, worked in, you know, state government, and have those relationships, and have kind of seen the world from the opposite end of the spectrum. That's who we hire, right? Those are the folks that you want to hire. So, you know, grind it out, and while you might not get paid a whole lot, you know, you just got to wait till you know, you can kind of flip the script and go get a job at a company or with a lobbying firm or whatever it may be. But people want someone that's got experience, having worked for, you know, state government, worked for a legislator, worked for a member of Congress, or mayor, whatever it may be, prior to you know, becoming a lobbyist. I'd argue that's probably one of the most important job prerequisites that there are out there for this thing. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's guaranteed you have to do it, but I would say that it sure does help.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you step into the world of government relations?
I mean, I guess it was, you know, I went from the kind of the campaigns and the like. So it was really, really at the Technology Association of Georgia was when kind of engaged at a meaningful level, where I was down at the Capitol, where I was, you know, working with member companies, understanding whatever the policies or issues may be. So, I mean, it's been, it was 12, 13, 14 years ago at this point, but, you know, it kind of took those steps and kind of weren't doing the congressional races and or campaigns, and then working for members of Congress and all the like, that kind of you're able to check those boxes and move there. So when I came to AT&T, I was able to have, you know, both public sector and private sector, in terms of, you know, nonprofit experience before I became, you know, here. So kind of really want to try and just, like I said, have those options, work in those different, you know, entities where you can kind of get the exposure at different, either different levels of government or nonprofit side or whatever it may be, because that's what I think helps, right? That gives you that exposure and it gives you that experience from a different mindset than maybe a company's going to come at it from. And we want to hire folks that are, you know, that can have seen the other side of the coin, if you will. And I think that's important. And it helps you to you know, right, when you're if you're a member, you know, worked on staff and you had some lobbyist, somebody come in that kind of gave you their pitch about what this, that, and the other, and you saw it right kind of on the regular basis, you can see what works and what doesn't work. You can see the approach, right, that folks that you know resonates and doesn't resonate. So you at least know kind of from the, hey, here's, you know, I remember this guy came in and they did it this way and it was a great pitch, right? Or this person came in and it was their approach was not the right approach, right? And you can learn from that and translate that when you go to the private sector.
Mm-hmm. And with AT&T, what kind of policies are you currently working on? And tell us a little bit about, you know, what is so exciting about working for AT&T?
So broadband, I think are the you know the big kickers and everything that kind of, you know, spurs off of that. You know, a lot of conversation the last, you know, 2 years around federal funding that's coming down to states, the allocation of those dollars to deploy broadband and you know, connect homes that locations that currently are not connected. And then what's coming down the pike, which is even more money through the infrastructure funding, through the BEADS allocation, the workforce component that comes along with the digital equity component that comes along with it. So there's a lot of dollars that are flowing to all states right now, or about to be flowing to all states to support this you know, broadband deployment. We've been working with the state, with all kind of interested parties to, you know, make sure that you know, we structure these programs in a way that encourages the deployment of broadband and does it in an efficient and effective way. So it's really about, you know, creating flexibility and adaptability for networks to deploy so that you can do it in the most efficient manner. It's also about you know, finding ways that we're not either kind of double dipping in terms of, you know, funding and paying for areas that have already been built overbuilt, or already have, you know, connectivity but that we can focus on, you know, the areas that are in need, and do so in a way that, like I said, put these dollars to the best use as possible in the most efficient way. And that's been, frankly, that's been a bulk of the world for the last, you know, 2 years here at AT&T, at least through my role, but also, you know, we work with the Public Service Commission. We work with, you know, legislators on a number of different, you know, pieces of legislation that, you know, are certainly impactful to AT&T, and certainly ones that we want to be part of these conversations. But the broadband is by far, you know, led the way with time, energy, and all the effort that goes into it.
And do you still get energized by, or let me rephrase the question, what do you get energized more by? Is it the policy or the politics?
You know, it's a good question. Honestly, I think initially it was the politics, but over time, as I've, you know, kind of gotten older, it's the policy, and even more so, I enjoy kind of the strategic kind of operations, right, of the mix, right? How do you develop a game plan, right, to engage on a particular issue, and then how do we, you know, advocate, right, for the right policy, right? What are the changes that need to be made or not made in particular, you know, proposal? The politics, you know, can like with anything, can be frustrating, just given, like I said, the many different variables. But we've got a good team here, and they do a good job of managing the politics, and I try and keep the you know, path moving forward with respect to what are the right policies, what's the right strategy, what's the right approach, and how do we engage in the most meaningful and impactful way.
With that, I would like to ask you a question on, what do you think are the two do's and two don'ts of lobbying?
I think the most important thing, obviously, is honesty, integrity, tell the truth, right? If you don't know the answer to the question, just say you don't know the answer, right? Say, I don't know, but I'll get back to you, which leads me to the second thing, which is follow-up. When you say you're going to get back to someone, get back to them, right? That's how you build trust. That's how you build those relationships. You can go in and meet with somebody and tell them what they want to hear, or tell them, you know, some fabricated story, and it might work the first time, but eventually it's going to get caught. And once that occurs, then they're not going to listen to you at all. Right. So you need to be upfront and tell your position. You just need to have the right argument. Right. And a lot of times folks think that they need to, you know, not be truthful or honest. It's because they don't have a good argument to justify why they're doing or what they want to do. You know, understand what it is you want to do, and then be able to articulate it in a way as to why it's important and how it can be impactful. If you have the right case, if you can make the right argument, you don't have to be, you know, circumvent the truth, or you know, manipulate whatever the facts or the numbers or whatever it may be. You can just state it out front but say, here's why we believe this, or here's why we think this is so important. And you know this is the contributing factor, and here's the numbers that we see. And but at the end of the day, you just got to be honest and upfront and follow up. People, they're not going to work with you very long. If you say you're going to do something, you never do it. You know, you'll find yourself, you know, bored pretty quickly, spinning your thumbs pretty quickly, because no one will return your phone call. If you follow up, if you do what you say you're going to do, if you look people in the eye and are upfront with them, then honestly, people will happily accept. Not happily accept, but at least accept bad news, right? Things that you don't want to hear. If you're like, listen, this is how it is, right? I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but this is the reality of the facts of how we see it, or how it impacts us. I'd rather be upfront and honest with you right now than you know, either one spring it on you, or just kind of, you know, go disappear kind of thing, and not ever follow up with you. So if you tell people what the truth is, and what the impact is, or how you see it, or what's going to happen, or, you know, all those things, then they prefer the bad news over no news, frankly.
Well, I think that's a very good way to conclude this wonderful podcast. Rich, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.